To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.
From NPR, it's Latino USA. Going outside of Washington to break through the numbing weight of politics. A conversation with a Tea Party leader from Long Island, New York, and a Latino activist in Columbus, Ohio. Ideas on how to map some common ground.
How are we going to move us all forward? Now, we're not all going to get what we want, but if the premise is basic human rights, it's the right to exist, the right to health care, the right to go to school, the right to have a job, and even to be a citizen of the world, if you will, how are we going to move this together?
And historias, Latino voices from StoryCorps.
My name, when I started kindergarten, was Ramon. And by the time I was in the second grade, everybody was calling me Raymond. You know, out in the playground, in the classroom, Raymond, hey, Raymond, hey, Raymond. And trying to adjust to this, you know what I mean?
That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Joining us to discuss the news of the week is Larry Burns, director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs based in Washington, D.C. Welcome back to the show, Larry.
Hello, Maria.
All right, so we have the World Economic Forum in Davos, but the past week, Brazilian President Lula da Silva hosted the World Social Forum, which is essentially the populist counterpart to Davos. The president from Brazil will be at both events. But Larry, what did he say to his compatriots at the World Social Forum about the Davos summit?
Well, as characteristic of Lula, he seems to be in both camps. That is, as he has moved progressively towards the center from his days as a trade union leader when he was quite a vigorous, robust leftist spokesman, he still throws around leftist rhetoric, but his programs are more and more centrist. And what this means is he has won a great deal of appreciation in Western Europe, as well as with the developing countries. And so his diplomatic clout is quite strong. As he becomes more and more leading a conventional nation, his rhetoric still is quite pungent.
Well, the World Social Forum that just passed and the Davos Forum, the World Economic Forum that's going on now, essentially are kind of two polar opposites. One is saying it's all about economics and money and transferring of and controlling markets and wealth, et cetera. And the Social Forum is saying we have a lot of people who have basic needs. How do these two things, can they in fact come together? You've got a president, Lula, from Brazil, who can go to both, but how can you actually bring any of these two things together? And does it happen?
Well, it can happen because it's rhetoric. But what I think the net result of all of this is that the developing countries have achieved much more visibility. Their agenda is much more respected. They're basically saying, look, don't talk about free trade unless you are prepared to talk about social justice and job creation and literacy, that kind of agenda.
All right, well, let's talk very specifically about some news in the week. This involves the new Honduran president, Porfirio Lobo. He's a conservative rancher. He was sworn in, and the Obama administration was essentially criticized for not taking a more forceful stance in support of democratic institutions when there was a coup in Honduras last summer.
Well, I think that the indictment against U.S. policy could be made even more vigorously. The United States may have won a relatively narrow diplomatic victory with Lobo's inauguration for the short run, but it certainly generated a great deal of animosity in Brazil and throughout the hemisphere in terms of countries who felt that any extra-constitutional change of government must not be permitted. And Latin America wanted to establish the principle that if you oust a constitutional president, you will be unrecognized. The United States didn't play by those rules, and I think the new administration here in Washington has grievously damaged itself and its reputation.
All right, we're going to move on and talk now about Haiti. Haiti, of course, is a French and Creole-speaking nation born of a 19th-century slave rebellion, but it essentially is surrounded by Spanish-speaking Latin America. Tell us, Larry Burns, is this a shift? Is Latin America embracing Haiti?
I would think so, and that's symbolized by the conduct of the Dominican Republic, which is a Spanish-speaking country that shares the island of Hispaniola with Haiti. Normally, there was a tremendous degree of animosity between the two countries, and frankly, it was based upon racism on the part of the Dominican Republic. President Fernandez of the Dominican Republic was very helpful this time in dealing with the Haitian earthquake. And I think that that established a very sound basis for a new relationship between the two countries.
And any other Latin American countries responding?
Oh, yes, they've all responded, because the fact that many of them were very close to former President Aristide.
Thanks for all that information, Larry.
Thank you.
Larry Burns is Executive Director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, a nonprofit organization that monitors human rights and political developments in Latin America. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. President Barack Obama challenged all sides in Washington to work through their differences.
So we face big and difficult challenges. And what the American people hope, what they deserve, is for all of us, Democrats and Republicans, to work through our differences, to overcome the numbing weight of our politics.
We wanted to understand how people actually do work through their differences, so we've asked two activists to join us to talk about what it takes to cut through the roadblocks. They wrestle with differences on the ground outside of Washington, so we're joined now by Ruben Castilla Herrera. He's a progressive community organizer based in Columbus, Ohio, and Dan Maloney, a member of the Tea Party and an activist from Long Island, New York. Welcome to both of you.
Well, thank you, Maria.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It seems like, and President Barack Obama basically alluded to the fact that the political conversation discourse, whether it's, you know, on the cable news networks or whether it's sometimes on the street, seems to have really unraveled. There's a lack of decency and a level of obstructionism. So isn't that true, Dan? I mean, aren't you basically saying, look, we don't like what you're doing, mm-hmm. and in a democracy, we can say we don't like what you're doing, and we can try to stop you.
America is an essential right country. And what we got was totally alien to the principles of the United States. I mean, socialism is not something that we look for, something that we aimed for. It's not enshrined in our Constitution or anything like that. And we're going to fight it.
But when you say socialism, mm-hmm. Dan, that immediately, some people I'm sure hearing this and saying, wait a second, I'm prepared to listen to the Tea Party perspective, but mm-hmm. when you suddenly say we're a socialist country, they're saying you lost me there. So just for clarity, and before Ruben responds to you, mm-hmm. what do you mean socialism? You're saying it exists now and that President Barack Obama brought it to the United States?
Oh, no. I actually don't blame President Obama as much as some other people do. I find I have serious problems with the Congress. Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, etc., they are ideologues, and they have their vision of the world, and their vision of the world is basically government control. And that's something we're antithetically against.
Ruben, so when you hear Dan talking like this, what's going on for you?
I am a little concerned when we get to the point of asking, constantly asking, what's wrong, what's wrong, what's wrong. And I'm more into the question of what's possible. So my question, even to Dan, is what's possible for us together, despite how are we going to move this forward? How are we going to move us all forward? Now, we're not all going to get what we want, But if the premise is basic human rights, it's the right to exist, the right to health care, the right to go to school, the right to have a job, and even to be a citizen of the world, if you will, how are we going to move this together?
Yeah, I agree exactly, Ruben. But you see, here's a different philosophy. When you talk about what is possible, I look at the broader implication of what is possible. What can we do privately? What can we do through religious institutions? What other institutions can fill in? Government is not the answer to everything, and many things it does very badly. There are much cheaper ways of providing the services we need than increasing the size of government.
But let me ask you this. Juno Diaz, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author, penned an article for The New Yorker where he basically is asking, what is the narrative of our country right now? What is the narrative, the story that President Barack Obama is telling? And essentially, he said that members of the Tea Party actually have a better story to tell. So from your perspective, Dan Maloney from the Tea Party in Long Island, New York, what is the Tea Party's narrative in this moment in history? And what do you see President Barack Obama's narrative or lack of? And then I'll ask you the same thing, Ruben.
Well, I think from the Tea Party's perspective, our message really is a message of faith. Faith in people. Faith in human nature. That if you give people freedom, it will work to the best. And the alternative message is that law, government control over your life, over your health, over your well-being, over your family. And so we're talking about freedom on our side, freedom and liberty. And that's our message. And that's universal across all Tea Party groups.
All right, Ruben. And so when you look at our country, at, let's say, President Barack Obama's story, his narrative, this is somebody who you worked to get elected into office. What's the narrative that you're looking at? Is it his, or is it rather you on the ground in Columbus, a shifting Latino demographic population, involvement with politics? What do you see?
I think I would agree with Dan in the issue of faith and our personal story. The only thing that's part of our narrative, our collective narrative, is that our country is becoming more diverse. And in fact, we know that people of color collectively will become a more majority. In some states, it already is. In some cities, it is. And what does that mean? What does that mean to me personally? How do I personally need to change? And change is a difficult thing to do because it starts with yourself. How do I need to change some of my worldviews or some of my perspective? And with the same time, helping move this country forward. And so I would add to what Dan has said is that this country is changing, and change is good. Change happens. Change is challenging, and that a lot of times that's where the creativity and the magic will happen. But it won't happen without some kind of a struggle. It won't happen without a collective conversation. But we need to do more. We need to continue to hold each other accountable.
All right, I'm going to actually let Dan, and we'll go back and forth for another minute, because throughout that answer, as Ruben, you were talking about kind of demographic change, racial change, the election of this country's first black president. Dan, who's with me in the studio here, your eyebrows were kind of twitching, like, well, what exactly is Ruben saying? So
yeah, I don't understand why you have to change. I mean, the change, if you're an American and if you're a person of faith or whatever, there's really no need to change. It's we're all Americans together. What is the difference of a person's skin color? This is not a black thing. This is not a white thing. This is not a brown thing. This is an American thing. We don't have to. I don't understand why you feel the need that you have to change because the demographics may be shifting. That doesn't change you as a person. That shouldn't change your outlook. It shouldn't change your principles. I mean, I'm reminded of Colonel Alan West down in Florida. He's running for Congress. Great guy. He gives some of the best Tea Party type speeches I've ever heard, and Colonel West is a black.
Because change is growth, and lack of change is stagnant. You know, it's the water.
You can have change, but it doesn't. You don't have to change your beliefs and your principles and stuff like that. If you have a sound core beliefs, you don't have to change anything.
If they are wrong, and let me say from my perspective, if I have a hardcore principle or belief that that in time I realize it's wrong, then I will have to look at myself and I will change. And that's how America has grown. That's how we women are allowed to vote. That's how blacks were allowed and were given voting rights. That's the question. The churches are looking at it in full inclusion of the LGBT community in the church. That's that change that I'm talking about, because sometimes those principles, because we are human, sometimes those principles that we solidly believe in are not right. And I'm not exempt from that. And so that's the change that we have to have individually and collectively. And only then will we move forward. And that's historically, throughout the world, we've found when that happens, we move forward. We have moved forward.
So essentially we've got somebody who's saying, you, Ruben Herrera, saying, look, change is good, bring it on. That's what's coming in the future. That's what it's going to look like. Get ready, hold on, because it's all going to be changing. Mm-hmm. And Dan Maloney, you're saying, don't change.
Have your core principles.
The world is
you don't have to change
you.
Those, yes. But the core principles of freedom and liberty and justice are
for all.
There.
For all. For all.
Exactly.
Regardless of documentation, regardless of your sexual orientation.
Well, our laws don't make exceptions.
Beliefs, regardless of your physical ability, for all. And so, and that's what I'm saying, is we have to be careful with that, because when you use that statement, then I agree with you, but it has to be for all.
But that's exactly
for me, or for people like me, or for people that believe like me, then that's when we have the problema. That's when there's a problem. Or people who speak the same language as me, you know. And so we have to have that conversation. We haven't been able to do it so far very well, but it's possible. It definitely is possible. It's what's possible. It's not.
But Ruben, do you know of any examples of laws in our country that are specific to a particular group, gives them rights that nobody else has?
Well,
are there any laws in our Constitution or anything coming down that says only specific groups can have these rights?
Well,
I don't think there are any laws like that.
People would probably say
you may have to go to court and litigate if there are things in place about not having.
Well, people would say in terms of just gay issues,
exactly.
Don't ask, don't tell. The fact that if gay people.
Want to get married. Exactly.
They can't. So that in terms of the.
We don't have laws specifically against particular classes of people or groups of people or subsets or subcultures. All of our laws are across the board.
And so that
and so
might.
You don't need specific legislation for a particular group. If the law is uniform across everybody, then you don't need a specific law for a specific group.
And I guess that would be a kind of place where we're going to have to leave it in terms of finding some common ground, where unfortunately we end with a complete difference in terms of you believe, Dan Maloney, that laws right now apply to everyone equally. And
yes.
I think Ruben Herrera is saying we have some work to do in terms of applying the laws across the board to everyone equally. And so
the application is what Ruben is complaining about, the application of the law. I'm saying the law itself applies equally.
What do you say, Ruben?
I'm saying that it's not. And sometimes the law is wrong and needs to be changed.
Well, right. I certainly agree with that part.
We found some agreement. All right, gentlemen, we'll obviously have you back
to
figure out where we go from here, from these very two different opposing points of view. Ruben Herrera is a community development specialist and member of Ohio Latino Action Circle based in Columbus, Ohio. Dan Maloney is a member of the Tea Party from Long Island, New York. Thanks again to both of you for spending a few minutes trying to find some common ground and where we go from here.
All right.
Thank you, Maria. Thank you,
Ruben.
Gracias.
Thanks, Dan.
De nada.
In a minute, cuéntame unas historias, listening to the stories of Latinos gathered by StoryCorps. That's coming up on Latino USA. Quédense con nosotros. Hi, it's me again. This podcast of Latino USA is made possible by contributors to public radio stations. They help pay the freight and cover the costs of making the program available to you to hear when it's convenient. If you're already a member of your public radio station, thanks. If you're not, I hope you'll rethink that decision and make a contribution to support this program and others like it. Visit us at latinousa.org to find a public radio station near you and join the ranks of El Pueblo que Escucha Latino USA. Also, great opportunities exist for companies and organizations to reach the Latino USA audience online, on air, and through these weekly podcasts. If you're interested in having a tremendous impact on the production of this program, consider underwriting Latino USA. For more information, visit us at latinousa.org/support. And thanks for listening. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Y ahora, unas historias. Time now for StoryCorps Historias. Today, three stories about going to school. The lessons learned back then weren't just about reading and math. School is where we learned how to act and interact with each other. In our first historia, Larry Hoover speaks with his granddaughter, Anastasia Garcia, in New Mexico. He remembered his teenage years and getting into trouble with neighborhood gangs.
As a kid growing up in Santa Fe, we had the Lucianitos on one side of where we lived, and we had the West Siders on the other side. So on Friday nights, I would fight with the Lucianitos, and on Saturday, I would fight with the West Side. There was no knives and no guns. This was part of growing up. Mm-hmm. And my mother would tell me, if you don't straighten yourself out, you're going to end up going to Springer. And Springer was a penal institution for juveniles. And lo and behold, my mother was right. 30 years later, I went to Springer, but I went as a teacher. They needed a graphic arts instructor and had my own print shop. And the assistant principal called me. His name was Antonio Trujillo. He asked me, are you Larry Hoover? And I said, yeah. And then I started speaking to him in Spanish. He says, well, your last name's Hoover, and you're speaking to me in Spanish. And when he saw me, he saw I had blue eyes and blonde hair, and he couldn't stop laughing. At that time, there was no fence around Springer. So if they ran away, they could get away real easy. But in the 5.5 years that I taught, I never had an escape. We had some really, really tough little boys there. I treated them like humans. Even though what they did was wrong, they were there for a reason to learn something and to better themselves. And I would reward them on a Friday with a barbecue, or I'd take them to the movie. I'd take them in a bus without no guard. My pencil was my weapon, was my sword. Because if I gave them a zero for the day, they couldn't watch TV. They couldn't go to canteen, which is the little store where they go and buy their goodies. So that was my sword. And not too long ago, I got a phone call from one of the boys there. He called me from El Paso, Texas, and he says, Mr. Hoover, this is Rudy. And I said, how you doing, Rudy? He says, well, you know, I'm the manager of a press here in El Paso, Texas, and we're going to open another store. Would you like to come and work for me? And I told him, oh, I'm retired. No, thanks. I'm out of that now. But that, to me, was my reward.
He did good.
I taught him good, and he did good.
Larry Hoover with his granddaughter, Anastasia Garcia, in Taos, New Mexico. In this next story, Ramon Chunky Sanchez gives us a student's point of view. Sanchez grew up during the 1950s in a Southern California farming town. And like many Mexican-American children at the time, his name was changed at school.
My name, when I started kindergarten, was Ramon. And by the time I was in the second grade, everybody was calling me Raymond. You know, out in the playground, in the classroom, Raymond, hey, Raymond, hey, Raymond. They're trying to adjust to this, you know what I mean? And if there was a girl named Maria, her name became Mary. And Juanita became Jane. Till one day, we got a new student by the name of Facundo Gonzalez. Facundo Gonzalez, man. When he came into school, we noticed they called an emergency administrative meeting. You kind of hear him talking through the door. You know, what are we going to do with this guy, man? You know what I mean? How are we going to change his name, you know? And one teacher goes, well, you know what? Why don't we try to shorten the name a little bit? And they go, yeah, well, but how do you spell it? F-A-C-U-N-D-O. And they go, why don't we just spell it F-A-C? And one of the teachers goes, well, that would mean his name would be Fock. And the other teachers looked at him, no, that, you know, that sounds too much like that, like a dirty word. You can't be saying Fock. Where's your homework, you know? Where's Fock at, you know what I mean? Well, that was a trip we always remembered going to elementary school because Facundo was the only guy who never got his name changed.
Ramon Chunky Sanchez in San Diego. This last conversation comes from Tampa, Florida. Lourdes Villanueva's parents were migrant workers harvesting fruit throughout the South. Here, she tells her son, Roger, about going to school while her family was on the move.
Everywhere we went, even if we were going to be there for 4 weeks, 6 weeks, picking the crops, my mother would make sure that they enrolled us in school. And Spanish was not allowed in the school systems. Even out in the playground, I mean, they used to have the little playground patrols, which were our friends that were supposed to turn you in if you were speaking Spanish out in the playground, which, of course, I was always in trouble because I was speaking Spanish. Then, of course, in the ninth grade is when you started working for credits to graduate. And we never stayed in one place long enough to get any credits. So why even bother? I thought I knew everything that I needed to know at that time and got married at 18 and had you. You pretty much grew up in the back of the pickup truck. I was picking crops. And in my breaks, I had to change a diaper and do whatever needed to be done and continue on working. And I always thought that you need to do what I didn't do, which is finish your education first.
You always said that you were going to lead by example. And I remember when you got your GED, you were in the fields. And instead of having lunch, you would have your books and you'd be studying. After that, I remember that you said, you know, I'm going to go to the community college at night. And I remember you taking one class and you started off like that. And then Dad was the one to take care of us, to cook for us. And we hated the beans and eggs because that's all he ever knew how to cook for us. I can remember us stuffing it under the refrigerator and then we would act like our plates were done. He used to make us eat everything because he wanted us to appreciate everything that we had, because I know that both of y'all came from basically nothing. And I mean, I was just so proud the day that you graduated.
I had to hurry up and graduate before you guys did because I knew you guys were coming right behind me. And
yeah, well, I really thought that was something special. If I was to have the choice to choose another mother, I would never choose anybody else but you. And when I looked for my partner, I always said, if my wife can be half the woman that my mother is, I will be okay. And I know I've never told you that, but that's the way I feel.
Roger Villanueva with his mother, Lourdes, at StoryCorps in Tampa, Florida. The next stop on the StoryCorps Historias National Tour is Los Angeles. A mobile recording booth will be collecting interviews in that city from February 8th through March 20th. Learn how to make a reservation to record your own interview on our website at latinousa.org. And for this week, this has been Latino USA. Thanks for listening. Latino USA is produced by Walter Morgan, Mincho Jacob, Angela Maldonado, Alex Avila, and Katie Davis. Our executive producer is Sean Collins. We had help this week from Manolita Wetherill at the New York Bureau of NPR.
Reporting for duty.
Visit us online anytime at latinousa.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the University of Texas at Austin, and the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR is provided by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary, on the web at healthreform.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.